After 9/11, suspicion and animosity toward American Muslims spiked. This hour, one man's view on how to protect religious pluralism from the poison of prejudice. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today is Eboo Patel, the founder and president of the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps. Patel says the prejudice against American Muslims, sparked by 9/11, is not just a problem for Muslims, but a challenge to the very idea of America. His new book is called Sacred Ground: Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. Join our discussion with Eboo Patel after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the decade following the attacks on 9/11, suspicion and animosity toward American Muslims spiked. Alarmist rhetoric, once relegated to the fringes of political discourse, became more mainstream. The idea that Islam is a menacing, deeply anti-American force. My guest this hour is interfaith leader Eboo Patel. Patel says this prejudice is not just a problem for Muslims, but a challenge to the very idea of America. His new book is called Sacred Ground: Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. In it, he writes how Americans from George Washington to Martin Luther King Jr. have been interfaith leaders. Eboo Patel is the founder and president of the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps. He was a member of President Obama's inaugural Faith Council and is a regular contributor to The Washington Post, The Huffington Post, CNN, as well as public radio. He joins us by phone for the entire hour. Eboo Patel, welcome to River to River.
Ben, thank you for having me back. I'm thrilled to be with you.
Let's start, if we could, where your book starts. You tell the story of the plan to build a Muslim community center near Ground Zero in Manhattan, the center to be called Cordoba House. Could you start by telling us the ancient origins of that name?
Sure. So it refers to the capital city of an empire in the Middle Ages in southern Spain, in which there was a kind of a famous pluralism between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. The cultivated nun, Horiswatha, referred to it as the ornament of the world, precisely because of its libraries and of its gardens. And so the way that I start my book, Sacred Ground, is by saying that America is the fulfillment, if you will, of this dream of pluralism that a Muslim empire had put on the map 1,000 years ago. We have this commitment to the notion that all people and communities can come to this nation and contribute, and that part of our commitment is to nurture positive cooperation between them. That was the vision of Cordoba House, to be an institution inspired by Muslims seeking to serve that broader American purpose. And I thought that at the beginning of the book, it was important to remind all of us how that vision of that institution really mirrors the vision for our whole nation.
Those of us listening here on Iowa Public Radio remember how this Cordoba House controversy hit our news, but you have sort of the backstory in this book, the story of the imam, whose idea it was, Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, how it became a political controversy. How did it start, that the argument that to put this community center somewhere in the vicinity of the Twin Towers, sacred ground, would desecrate that?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that I've known Imam Faisal for 8 or 10 years, and his wife also, Daisy Khan, and I've heard them speak about a number of Cordoba-related projects. And the vision has always been kind of like the vision of a Catholic hospital or the vision of a Lutheran college, this notion that people from a particular religious background would plant the seeds of their heritage in American soil, and those seeds would grow into an institution that served the common good. So they've had this idea of Cordoba projects in various parts of the country, and this was the highest profile effort to date, the idea of this really a Muslim YMCA in Lower Manhattan, just a few blocks from where Imam Faisal had a mosque. And so to it, and it it began by getting really positive attention. There was a prominent story in the New York Times, and there was actually an interview on Fox News where the interviewer said to Daisy Khan, "I applaud you on this project." So then what happened? Well, the project gets totally twisted into kind of a twilight zone, and a small group of people who are, I think, best known as Islamophobes and people who want to violate the idea of America as a nation that welcomes people from all backgrounds decide to call this a victory mosque for the terrorists of 9/11 and a terrorist command center, literally the opposite of the purpose of the project. And I think because of that really ugly language, it began to attract attention to a twisted, almost demonic vision, which again was the actual opposite of what it was intended to be. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of the book Sacred Ground really is to use this moment in American history to remind all of us about previous moments in American history when, for example, Catholics, where it was thought that every Catholic institution, every Catholic school, every university, every hospital was a Trojan horse for the coming of papal control. And then to say, what would we do right now without Catholic institutions, without places like Loras College, which is using my book Acts of Faith as their freshman year book read, which is within your river to river area, right? Without the 230 Catholic colleges in America, without the 600 Catholic hospitals that serve almost a quarter of all of us Americans. We require the contributions of people's different ethnic, religious, and racial communities. That's what makes America America. And so that's why I say that anti-Catholic or anti-Hindu or anti-Sikh or anti-atheist or anti-Muslim sentiment is not just a violation of those particular groups. It's a violation of the very idea of America.
Eboo Patel is my guest for this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you're a Muslim American. Perhaps you do interfaith work, as Eboo Patel does. What has been your experience over the past decade? We'd like to hear from you. Comments and questions, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. And on our Facebook page is also a link to Eboo's biographical information if you'd like to check that out. I wanted to talk about the parallels you have with the anti-Catholic feeling, say, half century ago here. But first of all, to follow up on the Cordoba House conversation, Eboo, it's very interesting in your book how you follow the reactions or how two prominent politicians behaved in this whole controversy, namely Newt Gingrich and a fairly newly converted Catholic, and Michael Bloomberg, a Jew, of course, the mayor of New York City, how they followed different courses. Tell us a little bit about that. It's especially interesting with Newt Gingrich because the earliest account you have of him is being very friendly toward Muslims on Capitol Hill.
That's right. So you know, what I basically do in Sacred Ground is I tell the story of how Michael Bloomberg, the Republican mayor of New York, is probably the nation's chief supporter of Cordoba House and does it in such a full-throated and, to my view, hugely inspiring American way, you know, saying that this isn't just about the Constitution means that we've got to let these people be here, but actually New York and America are about welcoming the contributions of different communities, and he spoke positively about Imam Faisal. And I have the backstory of all of that, including the young Muslim woman who is part of Mayor Bloomberg's cabinet, who tells Mayor Bloomberg, listen, this is the kind of place I want my Muslim kids to go to participate in arts projects with Jews and Hindus and Christians and humanists. Right, and so the conversations that Bloomberg has with Fatima Shama, whose story I tell in this book about Cordoba House, are really powerful. And then on the other end, of course, there's Mr. Gingrich, who spent a lot of time in Iowa the past few years because he was preparing for a presidential run, and he does the opposite, not only of Bloomberg, but actually the opposite of who he himself was just 10 or 15 years ago. One of the stories I tell in Sacred Ground is that I have a friend who was a staffer to a Republican congressperson in the late 1990s when Mr. Gingrich was speaker. And my Muslim Republican friend wanted to host congregational Muslim prayers right there in the U.S. Capitol, thought that it was a beautiful expression of America's commitment to religious freedom and religious diversity. Well, the House Speaker controls the space in the U.S. Capitol, so my friend Suhail Khan had to approach Speaker Gingrich to ask him if they could hold Juma prayers on Friday afternoons. And, you know, my friend Suhail thought it would take some months to convince Mr. Gingrich because space is so tight in the Capitol. But Gingrich, at a cocktail party, heard Suhail make a plea lasting maybe a minute long and immediately said, you will have the space that you need and I will have the House set up the space so that you can do your prayers as long as I'm speaker. In other words, Mr. Gingrich in the late 1990s was a strong supporter of welcoming Muslims into the U.S. Capitol. So why 12, 15 years later was he a full-throated opponent of a project as positive as Cordoba House? Why was he one of the lead fear-mongers about the presence of Muslims in America? Simply for reasons of political expedience. And I think it's one of the reasons that my respect for Michael Bloomberg deepened so much is that he did the American thing. And I say in this book that the most American thing you can do is to stand up for people who are different than you. He did that American thing even when the political cost was very high.
What is the status of Cordoba House now?
So the person that I'm – so in a way, there are kind of two founding stories to Cordoba House. One is a real estate developer's involvement with it, and the other is Imam Faisal's involvement with it. Imam Faisal is no longer involved for a variety of reasons. And as far as I know, the place is operating under a different name, under the name of Park 51, in a more modest way. But the two, Imam Faisal and Sharif Al-Gamal, had some sort of split a year or so back.
Now, let's go back to Newt Gingrich, because you point out in your book that this his behavior, his about-face, is ironic also because he is a newly converted Catholic. And you, as you referenced earlier, talk about what you see as a parallel story here between the anti-Catholic sentiment among Protestants, evangelicals in this country half a century ago, and the anti-Muslim feelings. Tell us about that.
You know, a huge section of this book is paralleling the anti-Catholicism of previous eras and the Islamophobia of today. And the great historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. says that anti-Catholicism is the deepest bias in the American people. And, you know, in a country in which a number of groups have been marginalized for a variety of reasons, African Americans, Native Americans, women, gays, that's quite a statement for a historian of Schlesinger's stature to make. The big fear about Catholics was that their religion was fundamentally antithetical to American freedom and democracy. And in era after era, this was brought up until literally the 1960s. And of course, there was that huge, full-throated effort to try to say that John F. Kennedy, whose wife would say he's not particularly strong in his Catholic faith, there was a huge effort to say that John F. Kennedy was the tip of the spear for papal control of America. And I literally think you can replace words from what was said about Catholics then to what is said about Muslims now. And I'll just read you a quick line from the book. In today's parlance, John F. Kennedy was part of a stealth jihad meant to replace the American Constitution with Sharia law, launch a Dawa offensive on the American population, and he was practicing taqiyya in order to get elected.
Go ahead.
There are two, I think, powerful and positive stories that emerge out of this. One is that America changes, right? In recent research done by Robert Putnam and David Campbell, we learned that Catholics are actually the most favorably viewed religious community in America. So from 50 years ago, where the big concern about John F. Kennedy was that he was going to bring the Pope and the rule of the cardinals to America, to 50 years later, where six Supreme Court justices are Catholic, both vice presidential Catholics candidates are Catholic, the current Speaker of the House and the former Speaker of the House are both Catholics, and Catholic institutions and Catholics individually do such clear and objective good for America in the form of the very institutions, hospitals, schools, social service centers, colleges in which people at one point thought that they were bringing the control of the Pope into America.
Mm. It's hard to, I think, for many to believe that the anti-Catholicism that was here a couple generations ago in the United States, at what point did evangelical leaders in this country, and you really point to the evangelicals being 40% of the population as really a key here, change their attitudes about Catholics?
So this happens over the course of the past 50 years, and one of my lines in this book is when evangelicals change, America changes. And I actually trace what I think is a really hopeful line about this, which is, you know, a cynical way of viewing the evangelical engagement with Catholics 50 years ago and how some evangelicals view Muslims now as well. Evangelicals are going to be prejudiced against somebody. I actually don't think that's true, and I think that's a cynical way of viewing it. I think the really powerful and positive way of viewing this is, wow, when evangelicals decide that racial reconciliation is a deeply Christian endeavor, man, they make big changes around it, and they change the country. When they decide that poverty or AIDS or relations with Catholics is central to their identity, they make powerful and positive changes around it. And one of the stories that I tell in Sacred Ground is about an evangelical leader I admire a great deal named Bob Roberts, right there down in Dallas, Texas, who went through his own transformation process with Catholics and then recognized that what was happening to Muslims now is precisely what happened to Catholics 40, 50 years ago, and is now leading the evangelical community, along with some others, to have more powerful, positive relationships with Muslims, and doing it in what we at Interfaith Youth Corps think is the most effective way possible, which is by leading interfaith service projects, bringing people from different religious communities together to serve others and therefore share appreciative knowledge of multiple traditions and build positive, meaningful relationships with each other.
Eboo Patel is my guest. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. His new book is called Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. Interesting, some statistics about Muslims in the U.S. Cedar Rapids, of course, the site of the oldest mosque in the U.S., Mother Mosque of America, the longest-standing mosque in North America. The imam of that mosque has been on this program as a guest. Tell us a little bit more about how long Muslims have lived in this country.
So Muslims have been here since really before the beginning. A significant number of the Africans who were part of the slave trade were Muslim, and many of them, of course, converted to Christianity, some forcibly and some willingly, and then a reasonable number of them revert back to Islam in the 1960s. And so there's been a Muslim presence and a Muslim contribution to America from the very beginning. And this is a very important part of the identity of the Muslim community in America, is that we want to be viewed as fellow citizens and fellow contributors. We're not wayfarers here. We're not sojourners here. We are part of the fabric of this country. We've been here from the beginning, and we want to be working with our fellow Americans to improve this nation for everyone.
The latest population projections by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life estimate the number of Muslims in the U.S. will more than double over the next two decades. That's from 2.6 million in 2010 to 6.2 million in 2030. the estimated growth will put the American Muslim population on par with the Jewish and also the Episcopalian populations in the U.S. That's fairly surprising. Why is, by some segment of American society, Muslim faith still viewed as foreign?
Right. Well, you know, this is I think what happens on September 11th, 2001, that terrible, terrible day, is not only the murder of 3,000 Americans, our friends and our neighbors, and my prayers are so deeply with their families. It is also the first time many Americans think about Islam front and center, and the first major piece of evidence they have about who Muslims are or what Islam is this terrible terrorist attack. It's like as if the only thing you knew about America was the terrible shooting in the Sikh temple a month ago. And one was deciding their entire view of America based on the actions of a racist, hateful figure who was part of a splinter movement. We at Interfaith Youth Corps think that the most important thing that we can do to advance the founders' vision of America as a place, in the words of George Washington, that gives bigotry no sanction and persecution no assistance, is to have a critical mass of interfaith leaders graduated from our college campuses to go out into the country and to build the interfaith vision of our founders and of our heroes, which is why we work so closely with places like Luther College and Augustana and Loras and Iowa Wesleyan and a number of the institutions from river to river, and we help those institutions become what we call models of interfaith cooperation and nurture this critical mass of interfaith leaders.
Well, thank you for also building our name into your explanation there. David is with us from Waterloo. David, we have just a minute or two before we have to take a break. Can you have a quick question or comment for Ibu Patel?
Hello?
David, you're there. Not much time before the break. Go ahead,
okay,
please.
Okay, all right. Let's get going then. Basically, your guest has made a lot of good comments. I think one of the things that stuck out to me is this project in Manhattan, you know, started out as a very positive endeavor, and then a small group of people, of radicals essentially, which is, you know, a little bit ironic, you know, commandeered this thing and, you know, made it turn into something that it's not. And the only way, historically, it seems to me, to be able to combat these types of people is to do things that your guest is doing, for instance, to write the book and to get out there and let people know, look, this is going on, and you have to fight this. You have to battle this and stand up. And eventually, as with the Catholics in this country, things will change. Things will change for the better, but you certainly can't just sit back and let these things go. That's a comment. A quick question. I'll take it off the air. I know you're pressed for time here. What do you think about, you know, in the same case with, you know, a potential future president of ours, Mitt Romney, being a Mormon? And there's a lot of anti, you know, Mormonism. People don't understand Mormons. And I've read lots of books that say that the Mormons' basic idea is to eventually take over to the United States.
Okay, we'll get a comment about that, David. Excellent question. Thank you very much. We'll get a comment about that from Ibu Patel, our guest, after a short break. We'll also have him go into further on, David, your other comment about interfaith work, because in this book, Ibu Patel points out that someone posed him a question that said, well, how do you measure your progress? How do you measure progress in your work? And he was stumped initially. Ibu Patel will tell us about those two facets when we come back. Sacred Ground is his latest book, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. You can join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Ibu Patel, founder and president of the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps. Back in just a few minutes with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday on this program, my guest, Voyager 1 scientist and University of Iowa space physicist Don Gurnett. He'll talk about the next phase of Voyager 1's journey, that now the most distant man-made object more than 11 billion miles from the sun. An update on Voyager 1 and the Final Frontier Monday on this program. Today, we're talking with Eboo Patel. His latest book is called Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America, talking about the suspicion, the animosity toward American Muslims that spiked following the attacks on 9/11, talking also about his interfaith work. He is the founder and president of the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Eboo Patel joining us from Chicago. And let's pick up David in Waterloo had a couple of points that I'd like you to comment on. Let's talk about politics and faith and the nexus of those two things. A specific question about Mitt Romney's faith in this election. But also, we want to throw in there that according to the latest Pew survey, 17% of registered voters think President Obama is a Muslim. That's 30% when you go to registered voters who self-identify as conservative. So tell us your thoughts on what concerns you about faith in this political campaign, Eboo.
So I think that attacks on anybody's faith or, frankly, anybody's identity, whether they are black or white or gay or straight or Muslim or Mormon, are not just attacks on those particular identities. They are violations of the very idea of America. One of the major themes of this book, Sacred Ground, is that America was the first democracy to believe that we could be a nation where people from different backgrounds build together a country. It's central to the American project. It's the reason that Ben Franklin opened a hall in Philadelphia and said that the pulpit of his hall would be open to preachers of any persuasion, even somebody sent from the Mufti of Constantinople to preach Islam. This is at the founding of our country in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. We have an obligation as a new generation of Americans to continue that project. And the reason that attacks on anybody's identity are attacks on America is because people bring their identities to this country and they improve the nation as a result. And while I might disagree with some of candidate Romney's policies, I respect the role that his faith has played in him being a better person and a good citizen. And I think that that's simply clear and objective. And I think it's the same with President Obama's Christian faith. And one of the things we ought to be proud of regarding both these candidates is how they speak respectfully and positively of other people's faiths. While there's been plenty of negative stuff in this election, I think that the way the candidates have talked about their own faiths and other people's faiths has been positive and should be a model for all of us.
Do you believe perceptions would change about Mormonism if Mitt Romney were to be elected?
I think that's exactly. Precisely, that's what would happen. Similar to President Kennedy in Catholicism, although Mr. Romney's Mormonism, by all accounts, runs much deeper. And the reason for this is something that social scientists now confirm for us, but it's something that we all know intrinsically by way of common sense, which is if you have a positive, meaningful relationship with somebody else, in most cases a personal one, but in the case of a president, it can be one formed through television and campaign speeches and the like. If you know somebody from a different community, your attitudes towards that whole community improve. This is a key finding from Robert Putnam and David Campbell's recent book, American Grace, and it's part of what we at Interfaith Corps call the science of interfaith cooperation. So the more that you recognize that your doctor might be a Muslim, or your favorite butcher might be a Muslim, or the presidential candidate you admire might be a Mormon, the better of a citizen you become because your views towards an important constituency of your fellow Americans improve.
Okay. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Eboo Patel, my guest, interfaith leader. Eboo, if you could chart, of course, anti-Muslim feeling spiked after the attacks on 9/11. If you could chart anti-Muslim feeling in the United States since that time, what would it look like in that intervening decade or so?
So if my memory serves me correctly, it spikes right after 9/11, which, makes perfect sense, again, because that is the single most powerful piece of evidence that people have for who Muslims are and what Islam is at that given time. And then I think they decrease slightly, meaning the negatives regarding Muslims decrease. And a lot of that is because of the leadership of President George W. Bush, who does things like goes to a mosque, who openly embraces Muslims, who says that Islam means peace. These are powerful symbolic actions by the President of the United States. And then what happens is that a group of people begin to whip up a fear and hatred of Muslims, in many ways mirroring the rhetoric of Muslim extremists who want to say that the only way you can be legitimately Muslim in the world is to act in violence and hatred. And there's a group of people in America, a small group but a loud group, who say, yes, that is in fact the only way you can be Muslim, and so we should hate these people and we should exclude them and we should fear them. And as I say, that's simply not true. It's a tactic that's been used regarding many religious traditions, Catholicism, Judaism, right now Mormonism, and it's being used with Islam right now also. And I think that those of us in America who believe deeply in the American project of pluralism need to, as your previous caller said, stand up against those forces of prejudice and make sure that we live out the founder's vision of pluralism for America.
Even though you point to progress here, I don't know if you heard this report on Morning Edition earlier this week. I wanted to play one clip that jumped out at me, certainly while I was listening. The report had to do with Muslims in Tennessee and where politics have complicated that. Here's the view of a Tennessee dentist, Lee Douglas, from that story, heard earlier this week on Morning Edition. And I'll ask you for your reaction, Ibu.
I don't want anybody to persecute any religion, including Islam, but we have a duty as Americans to understand that they intend to take us over and to compel us to become Islamic.
That from an NPR feature earlier this week, a feature that told us that the Tennessee governor has been forced to explain why he hired a Muslim. So your reaction to that and the prevalency of this type of view among everyday citizens here in the U.S.?
So that is precisely what would have been said about Catholics a couple of generations ago and for much of American history, is that they intend to take over and their faith requires them to. Literally, word for word, that's what would have been said about Catholics. And we owe the fact that Catholics are so integrated into American society and they've built institutions that serve the common good, not only to the perseverance of Catholics, but also to great leaders like George Washington, who sent a letter to the leaders of the Continental Army when he was the general, saying that burning effigies of the Pope, which some soldiers were doing, was such a stupid thing to do when your fellow soldiers, especially contingents from Maryland, are Catholic and they're fighting for your cause. And I would simply say to that dentist in Tennessee that we're on the same team. We're on Team America, and we're fighting to build a society that extends the American promise for everybody. And to say that because of my faith, and, you know, I'm holding Muslim prayer beads right now, and I'm preparing to go to see Bruce Springsteen at Wrigley Field tonight, I'm just as American as anybody else in this country, and I believe just as much in the American project of pluralism.
At the heart of the controversy is something called Sharia law. It's the code that guides Muslim beliefs and actions. Tell us what Sharia law is and the misconceptions that have been made about it.
Right. So, you know, there's some clarification about what Sharia is in the book Sacred Ground, precisely because it's become such a debate in America. And the reason it's become a debate is because a number of state legislatures have banned Sharia law, even though, I can't remember in 36 years of being Muslim, any Muslim that I know or even a report of some other Muslim seeking to implement Sharia law. Having said that, let me tell you briefly what Sharia law is. Sharia translates literally as the path to water, sometimes the wide path to water. And it is the broad code of what it means to be Muslim. It guides everything from prayer practices to funeral rites to how to probate wills. And it's based largely on the Quran, and it's based largely on the practices of the Prophet Muhammad. May the peace and blessings of God be upon him. But there is no such thing as pure Sharia. right? There are interpretations of Sharia, just as there are interpretations of the Constitution. And there are harsher versions of Sharia, and there are less harsh versions of Sharia. Let me make two things very, very clear. Number one, in any version of Sharia, criminal codes, you know, how to treat thieves and murderers, et cetera, play a relatively small role. The large part of Sharia is about the practices that make a believer a Muslim. And the second thing is, no Muslim is seeking to make Sharia the law of America. There are some Muslims who simply want the opportunity to get married in a Muslim way, which would fall under Sharia, meaning getting married in a Muslim way means having an imam perform your ceremony the way that a rabbi might perform a ceremony or a priest might perform a ceremony. And interestingly, some of the groups who were most concerned about the anti-Sharia legislation in state legislatures were Jewish groups, precisely because many Jewish groups want to have their own sacred law, halacha, govern private Jewish behavior, Jewish ritual, Jewish probating of wills, Jewish marriage and divorce and birth and death. And so this is an interesting area where multiple religious groups are saying there's a principle at stake here, and that's the principle of being able to practice their faiths freely, which, by the way, is foundational to who we are as Americans.
I wonder if you can tell us, we have about 10 minutes left, Eboo Patel. Give us people concerned about interfaith cooperation and furthering this. You talked about the science of interfaith cooperation earlier. Some tools in the toolbox that individuals can reach for to take action in their own lives.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, you know, a number of these tools are on our website, ifyc.org. We have a great interfaith literacy quiz on that site, and we have a number of articles that we've written. We point to articles others have written as well. But, you know, we at Interfaith Youth Corps think that anything worth doing is worth doing well. And so if you're involved in anti-poverty work or education or environmental work, you want to figure out how to do that most effectively. And interfaith work is no different. So we've spent quite a bit of time with the research around interfaith cooperation, and we find that it actually boils down to something quite simple, but when put into practice, very effective. And we call it the interfaith triangle. And the three sides of the interfaith triangle are attitudes, knowledge, and relationships. And basically what we know based on social science data, this is also common sense, is if you have a positive, meaningful relationship with somebody from another tradition, your attitudes towards that whole community and tradition tend to be better. And if you have appreciative knowledge of another tradition, for example, if you know that the most common prayer in Islam is a prayer about mercy, your attitudes towards that tradition and community improve as well. Therefore, we know that effective interfaith programs, whether they're run on college campuses like we do at Interfaith Youth Corps or run in Iowa communities like a lot of the people listening are involved in, effective interfaith programs are ones where people walk out with positive, meaningful relationships with people from other backgrounds and where people learn appreciative knowledge about people from other faiths. So we've tried to do our part in improving that knowledge base with things like an interfaith literacy quiz and ifyc.org and stories about people from a range of different backgrounds in my book, Sacred Ground. And, of course, we also offer tools on our website for people to start their own interfaith programs, their own interfaith service projects to facilitate these positive, meaningful relationships and to advance this appreciative knowledge.
Eboo Patel, what people do you believe in our society have you found to be the toughest to convince about the need for interfaith cooperation? What attitudes do you see, do you listen to, and have to fight?
So my experience is that once you begin engaging in a conversation with somebody who is somewhere between skeptical and even opposed to interfaith cooperation, and you articulate clearly what it is, which is not that every religion should be one religion, which is not that everybody should be religious. If you're a humanist or even an atheist, your views ought to be respected, but that it is about how do you build relationships between people from different backgrounds, which we think, again, is central to the American project. The very idea of being a diverse nation means that you have people with very different identities, and sometimes those identities are in contradiction with each other, and still we need to have strong relationships in our communities. You know, my friend and colleague, Pete DeCook, is sitting with me here, and I mention him because he used to run Congressman Bruce Braley's office and out there in Iowa. And one of the things that he tells me is that Iowa is a 50-50 state politically, but the ethic of Iowans, even though they might go to the ballot box and vote differently, is always to come together in communities. And that's what makes Iowa such a strong state civically, is that we know that even despite political and religious and other types of differences, we still need to be good neighbors with each other. And that, you know, from Ben Franklin through Alexis de Tocqueville through Ronald Reagan's City on a Hill and Barack Obama's vision for America, that is central to who we are as Americans, and we have to continue doing that even in a politically polarized environment.
Yeah, we are so polarized. That's the question. Why has this skill of listening to viewpoints that are not your own, that you don't agree with, somehow been eroded?
So I refuse to believe that American discourse in communities looks like what it does on cable TV. And I've been around the country enough and been to Iowa, you know, enough times to places like Lutheran Decorah and to places like Augustana and Loras to know that's not what it sounds like in those places. That, you know, although people have differences and they care about their identities and they want to express who they are, they're also always looking for relationships. At Interfaith Youth Core, we call that leading with pluralism. So I have my own political views and I have my own religious views, but I'm constantly looking for ways that my faith will build a bridge with your faith, not build a barrier. And in Sacred Ground, I call this articulating a theology of interfaith cooperation. What is it for you as a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian or a Hindu or a Buddhist that would call you to be an interfaith bridge builder? You shouldn't do interfaith work despite being Christian. You ought to do it because you are Christian.
In the 3 or 4 minutes we have left, I would like to end by having you comment on with some advice for parents, because you write about becoming a parent for the first time toward the end of this book. What can you tell us about nurturing your son's Muslim identity in this predominantly Christian country?
So the last chapter of the book is American Muslim Child, and you know, I tell the story of coming home one day and finding out that my Muslim son is fluent in the Lord's Prayer in both English and Spanish, and that puts me in an even more complex predicament than I'm normally in as the leader of an interfaith organization. What do you do as the Muslim parent of a Muslim child who you sent to Catholic school and whose nanny is Catholic, who is now able to say Catholic and Christian prayers with such fluency? And you know, I tell the story in that chapter about my son's Hindu friend next door and a birthday party he goes to of a Jewish friend, and how he's asking about what Diwali is and asking about what Mazel Tov means. And I end with saying, you know, what I realize is that when my son is around people from other religions, it's actually an opportunity for me to talk to him more about his own religion. You know, when he asks about who Catholic saints are, for example, who are talked about frequently in the Catholic preschool that he went to, it gives me a chance to talk about saintly figures in the Muslim tradition. And finally, it gives me a chance to say that your Muslim faith means that you care about all of these other people. You know, we do what we call our gratefuls every night for prayer time. We say our Arabic prayers and then we do our gratefuls, and we make it clear to both of our sons that we are grateful to God for giving us life and love so that we may love other people and improve their lives. And that's our gift from God in being Muslim, and we are meant as God says about the Prophet Muhammad in the Holy Quran, to be nothing but a special mercy upon all the world. And we're part of this great tradition of Islam in being that, and in this beautiful country called America, which gives us the opportunity to do that for a diversity of people.
I wonder, in closing, just a minute or so left, what impact on your interfaith work does the return of U.S. men and women who have been deployed in Muslim countries in which we engage in war? What has their return meant to your work? Because they have certainly had an experience with Islam.
Right. Well, they've had such an intense experience, and I mean the first thing that I think about when I think about those people returning are my friends who've returned, and I'm grateful to God that my friends did return, and I know that some don't, and that I am so deeply indebted to those families and deeply sad for those lives lost. And I know that these people have had intense experiences, both good and bad, in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the surrounding areas. And I would just say that I hope that they remember all the righteous people that they worked with in those nations who were Muslim in ways of being generous and being merciful and being truthful, and recognize that the people who were extremists were just that, just extremists.
Eboo Patel, thank you for spending the hour with us. Sacred Ground, the title of Eboo Patel's latest book, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America. And Eboo, I believe the website you mentioned to the Chicago-based Interfaith Youth Corps is ifyc.org. Did I get that right?
That's correct, ifyc.org.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ben.
And Monday on this program, as I mentioned a little earlier, 35 years after its launch, the spacecraft Voyager 1, now the most distant man-made object. It's more than 11 billion miles from the sun. New evidence shows it's nearing interstellar space. Monday on this program, we'll talk with Voyager 1 scientist and University of Iowa space physicist Don Gurnett about the next phase of this incredible spacecraft's journey. Monday on this program. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.